Port of Vancouver, gateway to the Orient. Rough, tough Vancouver, whose waterfront presents an ever-changing panorama of mystery and violence. A constant challenge to such specialists in crimes of the sea as Don Gray, Marine Investigator.
Don Gray. My business, marine investigation. And that means shaking hands with crime and disaster. But whenever there's low play on the waterfront, whenever there's a situation that doesn't have the honest smell of fish or lumber or grain, then it's Don Gray, the interested party's hire, to kick it around for them.
Good afternoon, sir. And Mr. Garin?
That's right. I have an appointment with Mr. Gray.
Yes, sir. He's expecting you. This way, please. Mr. Garin is here, sir.
Oh.
Please go in.
Down, sir.
Well, thank you. This is quite a mess we have on our hands, Mr. Gray. The crew simply refused point blank to take her out.
I didn't figure you'd want them to. Aren't you laying charges?
As owner's agent, I advise the captain strongly against it. Our job is to get the ship on her way. You've been at sea yourself, Mr. Gray. You'll appreciate the point.
Appreciate it, all right. It's a poor policy, Mr. Garin, to require a captain to overlook mutiny.
Captain Cardale agrees with it in this case. The papers haven't got the full story. You see, the circumstances are unusual.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't outright mutiny. The men were too terrified to go on with the voyage.
Terrified?
Terrified. Of a ghost.
Mr. Garin, superstition dies hard at sea, sure, but... when a ghost...
The trouble is, it's not only the ratings. The mates, the engineers, the captain himself are half convinced.
Oh?
That's why they made little resistance to the men's demand.
Are they quitting too?
No, they'll carry on. If they can get a crew and a replacement for the second engineer.
Second? He quit?
He was buried at sea 3 days ago. He died violently in the bunkers. And according to them, by the hand of the Stanford's ghost.
I went down with Mr. Garin to see the captain of the Stanford. The ship lay at Evans Coleman Wharf, and she was as ancient a tramp as I'd ever come across. She looked abandoned, with a starboard list leaning against the wharf like an elderly trollop. I had already learned she was carrying a load of coal to Japan. Captain Cardale sat us down in his room and produced the inevitable drinks. He was a young man for command, no more than 30, and not very sure of himself. I said,
"Your ship's an old-timer, Captain. Still coal burning?"
Still burning coal, yes.
Mm-hmm.
She's 42 years old.
You'll have seen many a port in that time.
Yeah.
Well, if you'll tell me about this ghost, Captain...
seems very real to the crew.
It sounds crazy, Mr. Gray, but oddly enough, there's something in it. Now, when I was advised you were coming, I mustered some witnesses.
Uh-huh.
They're coming now. Come in, come in.
Yes, sir.
This is Mr. Gray with Mr. Garin.
Gentlemen.
Mr. Gray is inquiring into the death of the second engineer. Sit down, wherever you can find room.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Gray... the first to hear the tappings was the cadet, Tom Wallace. It was the day after we left Comox, Vancouver Island.
Well, that's where you loaded your cargo.
Yes. The tapping came from the main bunker hatch. The trimmers were still working the lower side bunkers. There could be nobody under the hatch unless he were trapped. Tom called the third officer. Go on, Mr. Dent.
Well, when I got to the hatch, I couldn't hear anything. We were in heavy weather at that time, and the tarpaulin was secured over it. I thought it must have been something loose that Wallace had heard. But I tapped on the hatch with my knuckles. Sure enough, an answering tap came back.
Oh, that's
Bunning, I said. How can anyone be trapped down there? So I tried again. The same thing happened.
And what time of day was it?
About 11 o'clock in the morning, sir.
So what did you do?
Well, sir, the only thing I could think of was a stowaway. So with the cadet, I knocked out the wedges and lifted the magic cord. But there was nobody there. It was dark inside with the coal and all piled under the beams. But if anybody'd been happy to get out, he'd have been there, wouldn't he?
I imagine. Unless he was nuts or a very frightened stowaway.
We thought of that, Mr. Gray. We've never been able to find any evidence of a stowaway.
Okay, here's what happened next.
Well, I closed the hatch again and we didn't hear any more, so I thought nothing more of it. But that night, it began again. I could hear it from the bridge. The mate heard it, too, from his bunk.
Uh-huh.
Well, I saw him come out on deck, so I went down. When the tapping stopped, I knocked again on the hatch. The tapping came back. Maybe the mate would like to tell you what happened then.
Okay, go ahead, Chief.
Well, I called a standby man, and we opened the hatch. There was nothing there. I gave the standby man a torch and told him to go in and look. He refused. He was scared. Well, I went in myself, but I couldn't see anything. And that's all.
Up until then, Mr. Gray, it was only puzzling. When they reported it to me in the morning, I shrugged it off. A rolling ship makes all sorts of sounds. But it continued intermittently through the second day and night. On the third day, the trimmers were working in the tween deck, uneasily, but working, trimming coal down to the lower bunker pockets. It was Wallace, the cadet, who witnessed the next incident. Go ahead, Wallace.
It was at 12 noon, sir. I was just getting ready to eat when I heard a sort of strangled howl outside my port. The starboard bunker pocket hatch is there, sir. I looked through, and there was Frame, the 12 to 4 trimmer, tumbling out of the hatch. His eyes were staring out of his head, and he was choking. He was gasping, "There's summit down there, summit down there. Oh, God." I rushed out, and then some of the others arrived.
Uh-huh. Yes, Captain?
We searched the bunkers. We couldn't find a thing. It's very dark down there, of course, and we have no electric light. We used torches and hurricane lamps in groups. We even shifted some of the coal to get into the corners, without result. There was nothing but coal and the open trimming hatches leading to the lower bunker pockets. And they were empty. But the trimmers, now flatter, refused to go down. So the second engineer went down to set an example sort of thing. The next thing we heard was a fearful scream. We rushed below. We found Mr. Bray at the bottom of the lower bunkers. He was dead.
How do you know he didn't just trip?
There were marks showing where he'd been dragged over the loose coal. And one of his shoes was still in the tween deck, 10 feet away from the trimming hatch. We found his torch, too, in the tween deck. And it hadn't been just dropped. It was smashed, as if he had thrown it with some force at something. Incidentally, he was the chief engineer's nephew.
Uh-huh. Tell me, you, Frame, we haven't heard from you yet. What scared you down there?
I don't rightly know. I don't know, sir, but sudden light, my lamp goes out. Then something flashes again me. When I look up, all I see is terrible eyes. I didn't wait for anything else.
Look like animals' eyes?
They look like devil's eyes.
I was figuring the possibility of a cougar maybe having gotten aboard at Comox. Cougars don't play knuckles on hatchboards.
I can assure you, Mr. Gray, the ship's been thoroughly searched. But nothing could get the hands down the bunkers again. We had to burn cargo from number 2 hole to get back here.
Pity you weren't able to keep the body, Captain. It might have given us an answer. By the time we left the ship, I had something to think about, and it wasn't ghosts. Garen was sweating. He said,
"Well, do you suppose there's anything we can do?"
Yeah, get another crew.
We've already asked for one. There isn't a local crew of sign. The word's got around.
Yeah. I'd say it's a good way to cripple competition. Fly a crew from the East Coast, then, and ask the skipper if I can sleep on his settee. A long time since I made a trip to Japan.
Let go of the tug, sir.
Aye, aye.
Let go of the tug!
Pull ahead, sir.
Pull ahead, sir.
It was Max next day we pulled out with an East Coast crew. Some of the original crew had come back, led by the cook. The cook, the donkeyman, a couple of ABs. We dropped the pilot at William Head and cleared the Strait of Juan de Fuca by morning. And so far, nothing had happened. And then, at 10 o'clock, it began.
Come in.
It started again, sir. The tapping. Main bunker hatch again.
No. Well, Mr. Gray?
Let's go down. I don't hear anything.
Just a moment. I'll tap on the hatch.
Station someone there before we open the hatch.
All right. Mr. Vernon?
Yes, sir.
I better take the standby with you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let's knock the wedges out. Just a minute.
Yes, sir. I want you to come with me and stand by the bunker tween deck door.
Oh, it is that tapping again, sir. Oh, no, sir.
I hope you realize what disobedience means, Bailey.
Oh, you should never have come back, sir. I thought maybe Vancouver would have broken the jinx. I thought maybe a tourist or away you'd have gotten out by now. I can't go down there, sir.
All right, beat it. I'll go along myself, sir.
All right. Give a hand with the hatch, Bailey. Right. The top. Now take the other end of the hatch board.
Okay, Captain. Hand me the flashlight. I'm going in. Beyond the thin light that came down from the hatch, it was as dark as the inside of a chimney. Coal was stacked up to within a couple of feet of the hatch covers, and a pinnacle sloping down to deck level. Then I noticed a faint glow from down below. It was a trimming hatch. In the lower bunker, 20 feet below, an almost naked primer was throwing coal into the stokehold. It was working in the light of a hurricane lamp. I considered whether he could have been doing the tapping. There was no ladder at the hatch. It was designed strictly for trimming. I moved away and flashed my light around. Forward of the main hatch was a steel bulkhead. Abaft the hatch, the deck ran aft on each side of the thin engine room casing. I moved my light overhead. Nothing but beams from the underside of pocket hatches, all secured, and a couple of ventilators plugged from inside. I tapped the plug. There were wooden discs, a couple of feet in diameter. They were solid and fast. I moved up. Both wings ended in solid steel bulkheads. There was only a door into the fiddling, huh? I opened it. Vernon, the mate, was standing outside on the fiddly gratings. He had a crowbar in his hands. He looked a bit tortured, as if he was braced to both fight and run. We went up through the fiddly, past the galley, and out on deck. It's good to breathe the fresh air again. Went over to the hatch. I said, might be an idea to leave the hatch open, Captain, and see what happens.
In this weather, she'll be taking seas any time. The weather report isn't good.
Okay, close it down.
Bailey?
Yes, sir. A
minute. Before you draw the tarpaulin, let's try our own tapping again. Nothing doing. Okay, batten it down. Hold it now. Let's try again.
I should never have taken this ship out again. I tell you to...
That'll do. Get on with the job. Finish the wedges. What do you make of it, Mr. Gray?
I can see what you mean, Captain. You're going to have another mutiny on your hands if this goes on, even if nobody else is killed. We pulled a boner in taking any of the original crew back, Captain.
Frankly, I thought it was all over.
When do you have inspection, Captain? Sunday morning?
Yes.
I'd like you to make one this morning, Captain, at 11 o'clock. Quarters, storerooms, galley, and so on. Besides, I haven't met everybody yet. He sent for the chief engineer. His name was Bray, the same as the second who died. And we started with the officer's quarters. Bray, the chief engineer, was a good-looking 40, dark complexion, but a supercilious, vain kind of a cookie. My guess was women had spoiled him. He was the kind of heel they fall for, anyhow. He seemed to suffer the round of inspection like it was a concession to a skipper's idiosyncrasy. We didn't inspect his own room. That was the skipper's concession to him. We looked in the galley. The cook and his mate were working on a pot of Irish stew and a load of sweat rag duff. And I knew it was Thursday. On a limey tramp, you can tell the day of the week by the menu. I remarked to the cook, "Swell of you to come back."
"I don't believe much in spooks, really, sir. Spirits? Yes, in a bottle."
It was a kind of a joke, but I figured at that he wasn't enjoying it. It's the kind of joke you hear when the ship's sinking and the lifeboats are smashed. We went on through the rest of the accommodation, the crew's quarters, the cramped and gloomy places. There were the usual pin-up girls. Over a bunk here and there, a picture of a wife. Or a girlfriend, maybe both. The chief engineer never came into the quarters. He held back at the door. You could almost see him holding his nose. But I got what I wanted, a general plan of the ship. I took the next plan from the bridge looking aft, a bird's eye view. Abaft the bunker hatch was the galley with warship's weather plates before the doors. Then the fiddly, the engine room casing, the boat deck, the mainmast, the poop, where the men were quartered. The ship was rolling, now in a heavy sea, taking spray aboard. The canvas covers were on the ventilators. It was 8 bells, noon. I went down to dinner. It was then the next thing happened.
Captain, quick! There's a trimmer just sprung out of the pocket bunker hatch. He's fainting.
Which side?
Starboard side, sir.
What's the matter, man?
There's something down there. Something down there, Captain.
What? What do you mean? What's down there?
I don't know what it is, but it's breathing.
I think this is... Did you see anything?
Just a kind of shadow and light. Brushed against me.
Maybe you should get the chief engineer along, Captain. Didn't see him in at dinner. Anyhow, I guess it's his department.
Yes, I wonder where... One of you...
Oh, he's coming.
What's the trouble now?
Chief was in his boiler suit, a blue boiler suit, kind of dirty. He was wiping himself off with a sweat rag. First, he seemed more amused than sinister. I asked him, "No dinner today, Chief?"
"Oh, yes, when I'm ready, Mr. Gray. The engine room comes first."
"Having trouble?"
"Yes, keeping the stokehold supplied with coal. Now, what's the matter with you, Telfin?"
We told him, and he turned back on the man.
Nothing but mass hysteria. Get down below and trim that coal before we have to stop the ship."
"Now, sir, I refuse to go down in bunkers. That's flat."
Nearly all hands had gathered by this time, and their eyes and their mouths and their grim nods said there was going to be a first-class mutiny to get the ship back into port. The chief turned to the captain and shrugged.
"Well, Captain, if you can't do anything with them, I'll have to get my engineers into the bunkers, that's all."
"Then you'd better do that, until we get this thing resolved one way or another."
"I'll make another search of the bunkers with you first, Chief. Ready?"
"When I've had my dinner, Mr. Gray, such as it is."
We didn't find anything. The new second engineer was working down there, trimming coal from the tween deck now into the lower bunker. He had the third with him. They were working in pairs. Down below in the stokehold, the firemen had doubled up to trim it from there to their fires. The fourth was tending the engine. I knew they couldn't stand this for long. I decided to take a turn myself and watch change. But at 3:30, I was just dozing off.
Ah!
I leapt for the door. I bumped the skipper on the way out.
"In the name of heaven!"
"Below?"
"In the lower bunker! I am the chief engineer!"
"What in heaven's name was he doing down there?"
"Believing the others for tea."
The crowd was staring silently. It was Bray, the chief engineer, all right. I looked at the trimming hatch, 20 feet above us and back again. He was not only battered by his fall, his throat had been cut from ear to ear. "Well, Skipper, I guess that's it. I hope you're well off the coast."
"Off the coast? Yes, we're well off the coast.
Because when the fires die out, you'll be drifting. You'll get nobody near those bunkers now, even to take her back in."
"I'd better radio for assistance. Coast Guard, perhaps. Navy?"
"If necessary.
I want to take a look at Bray's room and go through his things. There's maybe a clue in the fact that the two victims were related. Let's go down. Take a look in the bunk drawer, Skipper. I'll go through his desk.
Yes.
There was the usual stuff. Log abstracts, requisitions, engine room catalogs, circulars, yellow with age. And then I opened a box. It contained snapshots. I riffled through them. They were all women. I said, take a look at this, Skipper.
Aye?
I figured him for a ladies' man, but it looks as if he could have taught Solomon a thing or two. Look at this one.
Yeah, it's quite a figure.
I wouldn't sneeze at her myself. And this. Who's this? Take a look.
Yeah. Well?
Does it look familiar?
Well, no. Why should it look familiar? There's a name on the back. Terry Brown. With love, Terry Brown.
Anybody with that name aboard?
Nobody. No Browns aboard.
But there is an enlarged picture of the snap aboard. Think back to our inspection. Do you remember seeing it somewhere?
No. No, I must confess I can't.
I can't either remember where. Captain, we're going to make another inspection. We find that picture. There's got to be a tie-in.
What's that? Nobody there.
No, but somebody has been. Somebody's been listening at the door. I didn't find the picture I was looking for. I knew it had been up in somebody's room, and it was no ghost that had taken it down. But there was nothing more I could do yet. The engine was still running, but the fires must have been getting low. The skipper himself was about petrified by now, especially when the tapping began again. It was 8 o'clock, dark. It was the third mate who called us to the hatch. He was sobbing with hysteria. Answer it, Skipper.
All right.
Keep it up, Skipper. Don't open the hatch. I'm going down through the fiddler. I kicked off my shoes, padded along and down the fiddler ladder. Between deck door was open, but something creaked as I slid through. I flung the beam of my light towards the main hatchway. I had a sworn something vanished as the light hit it. Then there was a movement of coal sliding down the heat. I moved the light under the whole area of the hatches. There was nothing there. I brought it down to the deck. The beam fell on a circular wooden cover. Ventilator plug. I sent the light upward again. There was plenty of room for a man inside the vent. I moved over and looked inside. Yeah, I could stand on the crosspiece and draw the plug in after him. But the canvas cover was still in the mouth of the vent. He'd have to cut his way up. I was trying to figure it when some more coal slithered. I doused the light and ducked. Yeah, it's a pretty lively ghost. All I could do now was ease back towards the door and hope I didn't slide down a trimming hatch in the dark. Near the door I stood, tried to wrap my ear. But all I could hear was the tentative knocking of the skipper on the hatch. I wasn't getting any answer. Now, and then, whatever it was, it was on.
I collapsed. Was touched deliberately. It lost balance. It scrambled away as I was recovering my own. And now I could see it. Nobody. Just some kind of a face with eyes glowing in the dark. I could hear it panting. My gun was in my hand. I didn't wait. I aimed between the eyes. The face disappeared. The body was hurtling toward me.
I put my light on it. It was human, all right. It wore a dark overall. Its face was covered in a black mask. The other mask, grotesque thing with luminous eyes and a bullet hole between them, was clutched in his hand. I pulled off the other mask. It was the cook.
How's he coming, Mr. Gray?
Up to putty.
Shall we give him another shot?
Wait a minute. I'm coming around a bit. He wasn't dead yet. We were trying to doctor him in the rat hole the ship called a hospital. I'd already been through his room and found the picture stashed away. He opened his eyes. Okay, Cook. Maybe it'll be easier for you to talk.
I don't mind now.
All right. Who is the gal?
My niece. Boy bring her up.
Terry Brown.
He was me sister's girl. She were orphaned in 1940. I give her everything I had.
So, what happened?
Bly, the chief engineer, came along. I didn't know him then. He ruined her.
Ruined her? How?
How? She took sick. Harder work. She drowned herself. But she left his legs. So I watched me chance to ship with him. It was too bad he's never come down first by himself. But why shouldn't I get his never to, huh?
Did the chief engineer know who you were?
Not until I killed him. Then I told him in the bunkers. And then you had to find a picture. So I
had to be next. I wouldn't vote for him anymore, Skipper. Even if it's doing anything left for him here.
He must have been mad.
You figure? Don't you think you could ever get that fond of a niece, Skipper?
Well,
let's go. There's nothing more we can do.
Don Gray, Marine Investigator, is a CBC Vancouver production written by Thomas Gilchrist with Doug Haskins in the title role. In tonight's supporting cast were Lee Taylor as Captain Cardale, Walter Marsh as Garen, Alan Routon as First Officer Vernon, Stan Jones as Chief Engineer Bray, Eric Vale as the cook, Juan Root as Third Officer Dent, Strolin Robertson as Stoker Telfin, Bud Slater as Cadet Wallace, Frank Vivian as the trimmer, Frame, and Roy Brinson as Able Seaman Bailey. Marine Investigator is directed by Raymond Whitehouse, with sound sequence by Ted Levesque and Frank Vivian. Control operator, Don Horn. Tonight's broadcast of Don Gray, Marine Investigator, concludes the present series by Thomas Gilchrist. We would like to hear from our radio audience concerning your appreciation of Don Gray, with an ear to future broadcasts. For the present, we make way for the British Empire Games in this Monday time period. If you wish the return of Don Gray, Marine Investigator, please address your requests to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, Vancouver, B.C., and head them up, Attention, Don Gray, Marine Investigator. This is Ray Nichol, trusting that we shall hear from you. And in the meantime, so long for Don Gray, Marine Investigator.